One of those closest to Ayn Rand was Nathaniel Brandon, a young philosophy student who joined the collective in the early days before Atlas Shrugged was published. In his autobiographical memoirs entitled Judgment Day, Brandon described their creed as follows, in part. Ayn Rand is the greatest human being who has ever lived. Atlas Shrugged is the greatest human achievement in the history of the world. Ayn Rand, by virtue of her philosophical genius, is the supreme arbiter in any issue pertaining to what is rational, moral, or appropriate to man's life on earth. Once one is acquainted with Ayn Rand and or her work, the measure of one's virtue is intrinsically tied to the position one takes regarding her and or it. No one can be a good objectivist who does not admire what Ayn Rand admires and condemn what Ayn Rand condemns. No one can be a fully consistent individualist who disagrees with Ayn Rand on any fundamental issue. Rand and her followers were, in their own time, accused of being a cult, a charge that, of course, they denied. But when you leave the religious component out of the definition of cult, thus broadening the word's usage, it becomes clear that objectivism was, and is, a type of cult. It was a cult of personality, as are many other non-religious groups. Here are a few things that characterize a cult. Veneration of the leader. Belief that the leader cannot be wrong. Acceptance of the leader's beliefs and pronouncements on all subjects. Persuasive techniques, hidden agendas, deceit, financial and or sexual exploitation. Belief that the leader and or the group has discovered final knowledge on any number of subjects. And absolute morality. Belief that the leader and or the group has developed a system of right and wrong thought and action applicable to members and non-members alike. Those who strictly follow the moral code become and remain members. Those who do not are dismissed or punished. In objectivism, we see all the characteristics of a cult. Deceit and sexual exploitation? In this case, exploitation may be too strong, but deceit was rampant. In what has become the most scandalous and oft-told story in the brief history of the objectivist movement, starting in 1953 and lasting until 1958, and on and off for another decade after, Ayn Rand and Nathaniel Brandon, 25 years her junior, carried on a love affair and kept it secret from everyone except their respective spouses. By their reckoning, the affair was ultimately reasonable, since the two of them were, de facto, the two greatest intellects on the planet. Amazingly, both spouses agreed to allow Rand and Nathaniel an afternoon and evening of sex and love once a week. In 1968, Rand found out that Nathaniel had not only fallen in love with yet another woman, but begun an affair with her. Even though the affair between Rand and Nathaniel had long since dwindled, the master of the absolute moral double standard would not tolerate such a breach of conduct by anyone else. Brandon was cast out by Rand, who extended the pattern of deceit through lies of omission. Missing from her open letter to her followers in which she condemned Brandon was any hint of the nature of the offense. Confusion reigned in the collective and among the rank and file. What were they to think about such a formidable condemnation for unnamed sins? It was the beginning of Rand's long decline and fall, of the slow loosening of her tight grip on the collective. One by one, her followers sinned, the condemnations growing in ferocity as the transgressions became more minor. And, one by one, they left or were asked to leave. When Rand died in 1982, there remained only a handful of friends. Today, the designated executor of her estate, Leonard Peikoff, carries on the cause at the Center for the Advancement of Objectivism, the Southern California-based Ayn Rand Institute. While the cultic qualities of the group sabotage the inner circle, there remains a huge following of those who ignore the indiscretions, infidelities, and moral inconsistencies of the founder and focus instead on the positive aspects of her philosophy. There is much in it to admire if you do not have to accept the whole package. This analysis, then, suggests two important caveats about cults, skepticism, and reason. 1. Criticism of the founder or founders of a philosophy does not, by itself, constitute a negation of any part of the philosophy. The components of a philosophy must stand or fall on their own internal consistency or empirical support, regardless of the founder's or follower's personality quirks or moral inconsistencies. 2. Criticism of part of a philosophy does not contradict the whole. For example, one may reject some parts of the Christian philosophy of moral behavior while embracing other parts. One may disavow Rand's absolute morality while accepting her metaphysics of objective reality, her epistemology of reason, and her political philosophy of capitalism. I have read Atlas Shrugged, as well as The Fountainhead, and all of Rand's nonfiction works. I accept much of Rand's philosophy, but not all of it. The great flaw in her philosophy is the belief that morals can be held to some absolute standard or criteria. This is not scientifically tenable. Morals do not exist in nature and thus cannot be discovered. In nature, there are only actions, physical actions, biological actions, human actions. Humans act to increase their happiness, however they personally define it. Their actions become moral or immoral only when someone else judges them as such. Thus, morality is strictly a human creation, subject to all sorts of cultural influences and social constructions, just as other human creations are. Since virtually every person in every group claims they know what constitutes right versus wrong human action, and since virtually all of these moralities differ from all others to a greater or lesser extent, reason alone tells us they cannot all be correct. As soon as a group sets itself up as the final moral arbiter of other people's actions, especially when its members believe they have discovered absolute standards of right and wrong, it marks the beginning of the end of tolerance, and thus reason and rationality. It is this characteristic, more than any other, that makes a cult, a religion, a nation, or any other group dangerous to individual freedom. Its absolutism was the biggest flaw in Ayn Rand's objectivism, the unlikeliest cult in history. The biblical creation story and the recreation story of Noah's flood are among the most sublime myths in the history of Western thought. Such myths and stories play an important role in every culture, including ours. Around the world and across the millennia, the details vary, but the types converge. For example, Gilbert Islanders, Greeks, Indo-Chinese, Kabbalese of Africa, Koreans, and Sumero-Babylonians believe in the slain monster creation story, that the world was created from the parts of a slain monster. The cosmic egg creation story of the Chinese, Finns, Greeks, Hindus, Japanese, Persians, and Samoans posits that the world was generated from an egg. Other creation myths include the primordial parents creation story, the spoken edict creation story, and the sea creation story, of which the story of Noah's flood is but one variation. We know that a culture's geography influences its myths. For example, cultures whose major rivers flooded and destroyed the surrounding villages and cities told flood stories. Even cultures in arid regions have flood stories if they are subject to the whims of flash flooding. By contrast, cultures not on major bodies of water typically have no flood stories. Does all this mean that the biblical creation and recreation stories are false? To even ask the question is to miss the point of the myths, as Joseph Campbell spent a lifetime making clear. Myths are not about truth. Myths are about the human struggle to deal with the great passages of time and life, birth, death, marriage, the transitions from childhood to adulthood to old age. They meet a need in the psychological or spiritual nature of humans that has absolutely nothing to do with science. To try to turn a myth into a science, or a science into a myth, is an insult to myths, an insult to religion, and an insult to science. In attempting to do this, creationists have missed the significance, meaning, and sublime nature of myths. They took a beautiful story of creation and recreation and ruined it. To show the absurdity of trying to turn a myth into a science, one has only to consider the realities of fitting two each of millions of species, let alone their food, into a boat 450 by 75 by 45 feet. Consider the logistics of feeding and watering and cleaning up after all those animals. How do you keep them from preying on one another? Do you have a predators-only deck? One might also ask why fish and water-based dinosaurs would drown in a flood. Creationists are undaunted. The ark carried only 30,000 species, the rest developing from this initial stock. The ark did indeed have separate decks for predators and prey. It even had a special deck for dinosaurs. Fish? They died from the silt churned up by the violent storms of the flood, clogging their gills. With faith, one can believe anything because God can accomplish anything. It is sad that while science moves ahead in exciting new areas of research, fine-tuning our knowledge of how life originated and evolved, creationists remain mired in medieval debates about angels on the head of a pin and animals in the belly of an ark. Let's examine a number of arguments put forth by creationists and answers put forth by evolutionists. The arguments are simplified due to time constraints. Nonetheless, they provide an overview of the principal points of the debate. Argument: creation science is scientific and therefore should be taught in public school science courses. Response: creation science is scientific in name only. It is a thinly disguised religious position rather than a theory to be tested using scientific methods, and therefore it is not appropriate for public school science courses. Just as calling something Muslim science or Buddhist science or Christianity science would not mean that it requires equal time. Argument: education is a process of learning all sides of an issue, so it is appropriate for creationism and evolution to be taught side by side in public school science courses. Not to do so is a violation of the principles of education and of the civil liberties of creationists. Besides, what's the harm in hearing both sides? Response: exposure to the many facets of issues is indeed a part of the general educational process, and it might be appropriate to discuss creationism in courses on religion, history, or even philosophy, but most certainly not science. There is considerable harm in teaching creation science as science because the consequent blurring of the line between religion and science means that students will not understand what the scientific paradigm is and how to apply it properly. Moreover, the assumptions behind creationism comprise a two-pronged attack on all the sciences, not just on evolutionary biology. First, if the universe and Earth are only about 10,000 years old, then the modern sciences of cosmology, astronomy, physics, chemistry, geology, paleontology, paleoanthropology, and early human history are all invalid. Second, as soon as the creation of even one species is attributed to supernatural intervention, natural laws and inferences about the workings of nature become void. In each case, all science becomes meaningless. Argument: there is an amazing correlation between the facts of nature and the acts of the Bible. It is therefore appropriate to use creation science books and the Bible as reference tools in public school science courses, and to study the Bible as a book of science alongside the book of nature. Response: there is also an amazing correlation between acts in the Bible for which there are no facts in nature, and between facts in nature for which there are no acts in the Bible. If a group of Shakespeare scholars believes that the universe is explained in the Bard's plays, does that mean science courses should include readings of Shakespeare? Shakespeare's plays are literature. The Bible contains scriptures sacred to several religions, and neither has any pretensions to being a book of science or a scientific authority. Argument: there are only two explanations for the origins of life. Either it was the work of a creator, or it was not. Any evidence that does not support the theory of evolution is necessarily scientific evidence in support of creationism. Response: beware of the either-or fallacy, or the fallacy of false alternatives. If A is false, B must be true. Oh, why? Shouldn't B stand on its own regardless of A? Of course. Even if evolutionary theory turns out to be completely wrong, that does not mean that creationism is necessarily right. There may be alternatives C, D, and E we have yet to consider. Argument. Evolutionary theory, along with its bedfellow, secular humanism, is really a religion, so it is not appropriate to teach it in public schools. Response. To call the science of evolutionary biology a religion is to so broaden the definition of religion as to make it totally meaningless. In other words, religion becomes any lens that we look through to interpret the world. But that is not what religion is. Science is a set of methods designed to describe and interpret observed or inferred phenomena, past or present, and aimed at building a testable body of knowledge open to rejection or confirmation. Religion is neither testable nor open to rejection or confirmation. Argument. Many leading evolutionists are skeptical of the theory and find it problematic. If the world's leading evolutionists cannot agree on the theory, the whole thing must be a wash. Response. Creationists have misunderstood, either naively or intentionally, the healthy scientific debate among evolutionists about the causal agents of organic change. They apparently take this normal exchange of ideas and the self-correcting nature of science as evidence that the field is coming apart at the seams and is about to implode. Of the many things evolutionists argue and debate within the field, one thing they are certain of and all agree upon is that evolution has occurred. Exactly how it happened and what the relative strengths of the various causal mechanisms are continue to be discussed. Argument. All causes have effects. The cause of X must be X-like. The cause of intelligence must be intelligent. God. Regress all causes in time, and you must come to the first cause, God. Because all things are in motion, there must have been a prime mover, a mover who needs no other mover to be moved, God. All things in the universe have a purpose, therefore there must be a purposeful designer, God. Response. If this were true, should not nature then have a natural cause, not a supernatural cause? But causes of X do not have to be X-like. The cause of green paint is blue paint mixed with yellow paint, neither one of which is green-like. Animal manure causes fruit trees to grow better. Fruit is delicious to eat and is, therefore, very unmanure-like. The first cause and prime mover argument is easily turned aside with just one more question. Who or what caused and moved God? Finally, not everything is so purposeful and beautifully designed. In addition to problems like evil, disease, deformities, and human stupidity, which creationists conveniently overlook, nature is filled with the bizarre and seemingly unpurposeful. Male nipples and the panda's thumb are just two examples of purposeless and poorly designed structures. If God designed life to fit neatly together like a jigsaw puzzle, then what do you do with such oddities and problems? Argument. Something cannot be created out of nothing, say scientists. Therefore, from where did the material for the Big Bang come? From where did the first life forms that provided the raw material for evolution originate? Response. Science may not be equipped to answer certain ultimate-type questions, such as what was there before the beginning of the universe, or what time it was before time began, or where the matter for the Big Bang came from. So far, these have been philosophical or religious questions, not scientific ones, and therefore have not been a part of science. Evolutionary theory attempts to understand the causality of change after time and matter were created, whatever that means. As for the origin of life, biochemists do have a very rational and scientific explanation for the evolution from inorganic to organic compounds, the creation of amino acids, and the construction of protein chains, the first crude cells, the creation of photosynthesis, the invention of sexual reproduction, and so on. While these theories are still subject to lively scientific debate, there is a reasonable explanation for how you get from the Big Bang to the Big Brain in the known universe using the known laws of nature. Argument. Population statistics demonstrate that if we extrapolate backward from the present population, using the current rate of population growth, there were only two people living approximately 6,300 years before the present. This proves that humans and civilization are quite young. If the Earth were old, say, 1 million years, over the course of 25,000 generations at a 0.5% rate of population growth and an average of 2.5 children per family, the present population would be 10 to the power of 2,100 people, which is impossible. There are only 10 to the power of 130 electrons in the known universe. Response: if you want to play the numbers game, how about this? Applying their model, we find that in 2600 BCE, the total population on Earth would have been around 600 people. We know with a high degree of certainty that in 2600 BCE, there were flourishing civilizations in Egypt, Mesopotamia, the Indus River Valley, and China. If we give Egypt an extremely generous 1/6 of the world's population, then 100 people built the pyramids, not to mention all the other architectural monuments. They must have certainly needed a miracle or two, or perhaps the assistance of ancient astronauts. The fact is, populations do not grow in a steady manner. There are booms and busts, and the history of the human population before the Industrial Revolution is one of prosperity and growth, followed by famine and decline, and punctuated by disaster. In Europe, for instance, about half the population was killed by a plague during the 6th century, and in the 14th century, the bubonic plague wiped out about 1/3 of the population in 3 years. As humans struggled for millennia to fend off extinction, the population curve was one of peaks and valleys as it climbed uncertainly but steadily upward. It is only since the 19th century that the rate of increase has been steadily accelerating. Argument: there are no transitional forms in the fossil record anywhere, including and especially humans. Response: creationists always quote Darwin's famous passage in The Origin of Species, in which he asks, "Why then is not every geological formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain, and this, perhaps, is the gravest objection which can be urged against my theory." Creationists end the quote there and ignore the rest of Darwin's chapter, in which he addresses this problem. One answer is that plenty of examples of transitional forms have been discovered since Darwin's time. Just look in any paleontology text. The fossil Archaeopteryx, part reptile, part bird, is a classic example of a transitional form. We now have a treasure trove of human transitional forms. A second answer is a rhetorical one. Creationists demand just one transitional fossil. When you give it to them, they then claim there is a gap between these two fossils and ask you to present a transitional form between these two. If you do, then there are now two more gaps in the fossil record, and so on ad infinitum. Simply pointing this out refutes the argument. A third answer was provided in 1972 by Niles Eldridge and Stephen Jay Gould when they argued that gaps in the fossil record do not indicate missing data of slow and stately change. Rather, so-called missing fossils are evidence of rapid and episodic change. They showed that the relatively rapid change in this smaller gene pool creates new species but leaves behind few, if any, fossils. The process of fossilization is rare and infrequent anyway, but it is almost non-existent during these times of rapid speciation because the number of individuals is small and the change is swift. A lack of fossils may be evidence for rapid change, not missing evidence for gradual evolution. Argument: if evolution is gradual, there should be no gaps between species. Response: evolution is not always gradual. It is often quite sporadic. An evolutionist never said there would not be gaps. Finally, gaps do not prove creation any more than blank spots in human history prove that all civilizations were spontaneously created. Argument: the incipient structure problem refutes natural selection. a new structure that evolves slowly over time would not provide an advantage to the organism in its beginning or intermediate stages, only when it is completely developed, which can only happen by special creation. What good is 5% of a wing, or 55%? You need all or nothing. Response: a poorly developed wing may have been a well-developed something else, like a thermoregulator for ectothermic reptiles. And it is not true that incipient stages are completely useless. 5% vision is significantly better than none, and being able to get airborne for any length of time can provide an adaptive advantage. Argument: the whole history of evolutionary theory in particular, and science in general, is the history of mistaken theories and overthrown ideas. Nebraska Man, Piltdown Man, Calaveras Man, and Hesperopithecus are just a few of the blunders scientists have made. Clearly, science cannot be trusted, and modern theories are no better than past ones. Response: this argument reveals a gross misunderstanding of the nature of science. Science does not just change. It constantly builds upon the ideas of the past, and it is cumulative toward the future. Scientists do make mistakes aplenty, and in fact, this is how science progresses. The self-correcting feature of the scientific method is one of its most beautiful features. Hoaxes like Piltdown Man and honest mistakes like Hesperopithecus are in time exposed. Science picks itself up, shakes itself off, and moves on. A 1991 Gallup poll found that 47% of Americans believe that God created man pretty much in his present form at one time within the last 10,000 years. A centrist view that man has developed over millions of years from less advanced forms of life, but God guided this process, including man's creation, was held by 40% of Americans. Only 9% believe that man has developed over millions of years from less advanced forms of life. God had no part in this process. The remaining 4% answered, "I don't know." 99% of scientists take the strict naturalist view shared by only 9% of Americans. This is a startling difference. It would be hard to imagine any other belief for which there is such a wide disparity between the person on the street and the expert in the ivory tower. Yet, science is the dominant force in our culture, so in order to gain respectability, and what is more important for creationists, access to public school science classrooms, creationists have been forced to deal with this powerful minority. Over the past 80 years, creationists have used three basic strategies to press their religious beliefs: banning evolution, getting equal time for Genesis and Darwin, and getting equal time for creation science and evolution science. In the 1920s, a perceived degeneration in the moral fiber of America was linked to Darwin's theory of evolution. Fundamentalists rallied to check the moral decline by removing evolution from the public schools. In 1923, Oklahoma passed a bill offering free textbooks to public schools on the condition that neither the teachers nor the textbooks mentioned evolution. Florida went even further by passing an anti-evolution law. In 1925, the Butler Act, which made it unlawful for any public school teacher, quote, "to teach any theory that denies the story of the divine creation of man as taught in the Bible, and to teach instead that man has descended from a lower order of animals," unquote, was passed by the Tennessee legislature. This act was viewed as an obvious violation of civil liberties and resulted in the famous 1925 Scopes monkey trial. John T. Scopes was a substitute teacher who volunteered to provide the test case by which the American Civil Liberties Union could challenge Tennessee's anti-evolution law. The ACLU intended to take the case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court if necessary. Clarence Darrow, the most famous defense attorney of the day, provided legal counsel for Scopes, and William Jennings Bryan, three-time presidential candidate and known voice of biblical fundamentalism, served as defender of the faith for the prosecution. The trial was labeled the Trial of the Century. The two giants pontificated for days, but in the end, Scopes was found guilty and fined $100 by Judge Ralston. Scopes did indeed break the law. Because of a little-known catch in Tennessee law, which required all fines above $50 to be set by a jury, not a judge, the defense was not able to appeal the case. It never was taken to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the law stood on the books until 1967. Most people think that Scopes, Darrow, and the scientific community scored a great victory in Tennessee. But in fact, there was no victory for evolution. Brian died a few days after the trial ended, but he had the last laugh, as the controversy stirred by the trial made others, particularly textbook publishers and state boards of education, reluctant to deal with the theory of evolution in any manner. So matters stood for over 30 years until October 4, 1957. On that day, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik 1, the first orbiting artificial satellite, thereby announcing to America that, unlike political secrets, nature's secrets cannot be concealed. No nation can hold a monopoly on the laws of nature. The Sputnik scare prompted a renaissance in American science education, during which evolution worked its way back into the mainstream of public education. The next generation of fundamentalists and biblical literalists responded with a new approach. In the late 1960s and early 70s, they demanded equal time for the Genesis story and the theory of evolution. They insisted that evolution was only a theory, not a fact, and should be designated as such. Organizations like the Creation Research Society, founded in 1963, helped push through creationist legislation. For example, in 1963, the State Senate of Tennessee passed by a vote of 69-16 a bill that required all textbooks to carry a disclaimer that any idea about, quote, "the origin and creation of man and his world is not represented to be scientific fact," unquote. The Bible, designated as a reference book instead of a textbook, was exempt from the disclaimer. The bill was appealed by the National Association of Biology Teachers on First Amendment arguments. At about the same time, Susan Epperson, a high school biology teacher in Little Rock, Arkansas, filed suit against the state on the grounds that an anti-evolution bill passed in 1929 violated her rights to free speech. She won, but the case was overturned by the Arkansas Supreme Court in 1967 and later appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. In 1967, Tennessee repealed its anti-evolution law, and in 1968, the U.S. Supreme Court found Susan Epperson in the right. The court interpreted the 1929 Arkansas law as an attempt to establish a religious position in a public classroom. The Arkansas law was overturned, and the court ruled all such anti-evolution laws unconstitutional. If evolution could not be excluded from the classroom, and if the teaching of religious tenets was unconstitutional, creationists needed a new strategy to gain access to public school classrooms. Enter creation science. The argument was that since academic honesty calls for a balanced treatment of competing ideas, creation science should be taught side by side with evolution science. Backers made a clear distinction between biblical creationism, with its openly fundamentalist religious basis, and scientific creationism, which emphasized the non-religious scientific evidence against evolution and in favor of creation. Throughout the late 1970s and 1980s, the Creation Science Research Center, the Institute for Creation Research, the Bible Science Association, and other such organizations press state boards of education and textbook publishers to include the science of creation alongside the science of evolution. On the legal end of this strategy, in 1981, Act 590 was enacted in Arkansas, requiring, quote, "balanced treatment of creation science and evolution science in public schools," unquote. A year later, the state of Louisiana passed a similar bill. The constitutionality of Act 590 was challenged on May 27, 1981, with the filing of a suit by Reverend Bill McLean and others. The case was brought to trial in Little Rock on December 7, 1981, as McLean versus Arkansas. The contestants were, on one side, established science, scholarly religion, and liberal teachers, backed by the ACLU. On the other side were the Arkansas Board of Education and various creationists. Federal Judge William R. Overton of Arkansas ruled against the state on the grounds that creation science conveys, quote, an inescapable religiosity, unquote, and is therefore unconstitutional, and that creation science fails to meet the essential characteristics of science. Despite this decision, creationists continued their lobbying for equal time laws and revised textbooks. But this top-down strategy of passing laws and pressuring textbook publishers was hampered by the outcome of the case against the Louisiana law. In 1985, the Louisiana law was struck down by summary judgment, meaning without trial, in the Federal Court of Louisiana. There, U.S. District Judge Adrian Duplantier ruled in concurrence with Judge Overton that creation science was actually religious dogma. The decision was appealed to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. That court agreed with the district court that the statute was unconstitutional. But when a federal court holds a state statute unconstitutional, by mandatory jurisdiction, the U.S. Supreme Court must hear the case. The initial oral arguments in Edwards v. Aguillard were made on December 10, 1986, with Wendell Byrd representing the appellants and Jay Topkiss and the ACLU the appellees. Using a minimalist approach, Topkiss argued that creation science was merely religion, posing as science, and was therefore unconstitutional. In this instance, however, the argument failed on the grounds that if the science were valid, it should have a place in the curriculum of public school science classes, no matter what its relation to religion. The justices' historical analogies brilliantly countered Topkiss's arguments. For example, Chief Justice William Rehnquist demonstrated to Topkiss that it is possible to believe in the creation of life by God with no religious intent. Later in the arguments, Justice Antonin Scalia provided an enlightening historical argument about the irrelevancy of intent. Since the argument attacking the religious motivations of the creationists was not valid in the view of the court, another tack was needed. Denying the scientific content of creation science seemed to be the only hope for the appellees. What was needed was a clear-cut and succinct definition of science, so that the court could see that the scientific content of creation science failed to meet criteria that would legitimize its claim to supposed scientific standing. In spite of centuries of attention by scientists and philosophers of science, no concise definition of science has ever been accepted by the community of scientists and scholars. This situation changed temporarily with the amicus curiae brief submitted on August 18, 1986, to the Supreme Court. For this brief, the amici managed to define and agree upon the nature and scope of science. The brief was instigated by Murray Galman, Paul McCready, and other members of the Southern California Skeptic Society after they read in the Los Angeles Times that the U.S. Supreme Court had agreed to hear the Louisiana case. The scientific community responded thoroughly and positively. For example, the Iowa Academy of Science joined the amici and sent a copy of their position statement on creationism as a scientific explanation of natural phenomena. Nobel laureate Leon Cooper sent a copy of a lecture he had given on creation science. The amicus curiae brief is concise, well documented, and argues that, on the one hand, creation science is just a new label for the old religious doctrines of decades past. On the other hand, it does not meet the criteria of science as defined in the brief by the amici. That definition reads, in part, science is devoted to formulating and testing naturalistic explanations for natural phenomena. It is a process for systematically collecting and recording data about the physical world then categorizing and studying the collected data in an effort to infer the principles of nature that best explain the observed phenomena." Unquote. The brief goes on to describe the scientific method, beginning with the collection of facts upon which testable hypotheses are formed. According to the amici, any body of knowledge accumulated within the guidelines they described is considered scientific and suitable for public school education. Any body of knowledge not accumulated within these guidelines is not considered scientific. By this line of reasoning, in singling out evolutionary theory as speculative and baseless compared to other proven scientific facts, the Louisiana law is not consistent. Rather, even though the theory of evolution is considered by virtually all biologists to be as robust and reliable as any in science, it has attracted the attention of creationists because they perceive it as directly opposing their static and inflexible religious beliefs. The amici thus conclude, "The act, however construed, is structured to convey a message that religion or a particular religious belief is favored or preferred." Unquote. It is thus unconstitutional. The Creation Research Legal Defense Fund immediately took up a collection to support its stand against the amicus brief. Noting that the brief had struck a significant blow, a fundraising letter requested creationists to please pray about sending us the best possible gift you can. The case was decided on June 19, 1987. The Supreme Court voted 7-2 in favor of the appellees. The court held that, quote, "The act impermissibly endorses religion by advancing the religious belief that a supernatural being created humankind." Unquote. The Louisiana trial in general, and the amicus brief in particular, had the effect of temporarily galvanizing the scientific community into not only defending science as a way of understanding the world that is different from religion, but defining science as a body of knowledge accumulated through a particular method, the scientific method. The event has significance in the history of science in that it unified a diverse group of individuals, perhaps best characterized by their fierce independence. It would seem that there are two possible explanations for this unity. First, the scientific community felt itself directly under attack from the outside, and, as social psychologists have demonstrated, in such conditions almost any group will respond by circling the wagons. Yet scientists have encountered outside forces before and have not responded quite so collectively and emotionally. A second factor in explaining the unification in the Louisiana case may be the nearly unanimous perception that the creationist position lacked any validity whatsoever. Gelman noted, "It wasn't that the creationists are religious, it's that they are claiming to be presenting science when it is really just total nonsense. It would be like the Flat Earth Society insisting their theory be taught in the public schools." Unquote. These two components explain why the defense and definition of science was an interim one. It lasted for the duration of the case and was left there to be recalled should similar circumstances again arise. Certainly, philosophers of science have not suspended their research into the nature of science and the scientific method with the publication of the brief. This agreement was made politically, not philosophically. In our democratic society, such conflicts are solved, if only for a while, by a vote. In the Louisiana case, the vote was taken, and the court followed the advice of the defenders of science, the scientists themselves. On March 14, 1994, Phil Donahue became the first of the talk show hosts to address the Holocaust deniers, who claimed that this event was radically different from what we have all come to accept. Many of the major talk shows had considered doing something on the subject, yet for a variety of reasons had not done so before. Montel Williams had taped a program on April 30, 1992, but it was pulled from major markets because, according to the deniers, they looked too good and the Holocaust scholar offered nothing better than ad hominem attacks, that is, attacks on the person instead of their ideas. I saw the show, and the deniers were correct. if it had been a fight, they would have stopped it. The Donahue producer promised us that there would be no skinheads or neo-Nazis, nor would the show be allowed to erupt into violence or degenerate into mere shouting. The deniers were promised that they would be allowed to make their claims. I, in turn, was promised that I could properly answer their arguments. The deniers were represented by Bradley Smith, who places advertisements in college newspapers, and David Cole, the young Jewish video producer who primarily focuses on denying that gas chambers and crematoria were used for mass murder. Edith Glick, who had been in Auschwitz, albeit for only a few weeks, also appeared on the show. Her close friend Judith Berg, who had been in Auschwitz for 7 months, was seated in the studio audience. What was promised was quite different from what actually unfolded on the air. It was obvious from the start that Donahue was in over his head. He knew little about the Holocaust and even less about the debating style of the deniers. He immediately tried to reduce the discussion to accusations of anti-Semitism. As Smith and Cole desperately tried to make their points, Donahue continually returned to the issue of anti-Semitism and tried to associate Cole with the noted neo-Nazi Ernst Zundel. On a commercial break, I was escorted into the studio. My entrance had the look and feel of a prize fighter going into the ring. The producer told me to stay away from the technical matters and stick to analyzing their methods. In the days prior to the show, he had interviewed me extensively, and I had told him everything I would say. There should have been no surprises. I launched into my presentation, knowing that I only had a few minutes. After summarizing the methods of deniers, I began to move into their specific claims. Now was the time to put up on the screen the photographs and blueprints of gas chambers and crematoria, and the short quotes about elimination and extermination of Jews that I had provided. Instead, Donahue showed film footage from Dachau, now known not to have been an extermination camp. Unfortunately, no one had told Donahue where the footage was taken or anything else about it. Cole promptly nailed him. Donahue admitted that he wasn't sure the clip was Dachau. Cole reacted, "You're not sure that was Dachau? You show a clip on your show and you're not sure it was Dachau?" I jumped in to try to redirect the discussion back to the point. I said, "History is knowledge, and like all knowledge, it progresses and changes. We continually refine our certainty about claims, and that's what historical revisionism is all about." Meanwhile, David Cole left the studio, disgusted he had not been allowed to make his points. Donahue said, "Let him walk." Chaos erupted. At one point in the broadcast, Smith used the example of the widespread belief that the Germans cooked Jews to make soap. He called it a lie. I countered, "No, not a lie. It's a mistake." Holocaust survivor Judith Berg shouted from the front row, "It was true. They made lampshades and they cooked soap. That's true." Because Mrs. Berg had told me that she had seen Nazis burning large numbers of bodies in an open field, I began to explain, "They burnt bodies in mass graves," but I was cut off when Donahue broke for a commercial. Before the show, I had told both Mrs. Berg and Mrs. Glick not to exaggerate or embellish anything, to just tell the audience exactly what they remembered. Most survivors know little about the Holocaust outside of what happened to them half a century ago, and deniers are good at tripping them up when they get dates wrong, or, worse, claim they saw something or someone they could not have seen. By turning her actual experience of seeing burning bodies into evidence for human soap, Mrs. Berg provided a perfect setup, and Smith capitalized on it. He not only avoided the issue of burning bodies and undermined the credibility of what Mrs. Berg did see, but also managed to make it look as if I and other Holocaust historians were on his side. Donahue, having exhausted his knowledge of the Holocaust, returned to the free speech issues and, once again, anti-Semitism and ad hominem attacks on Smith's character and credentials. I thought that the program was a total disaster and the deniers had bested me, that I had made a fool of myself in front of my colleagues, and let down the historical profession. Apparently, the viewers perceive differently. I have received hundreds of calls and letters from historians and the general public telling me that the deniers look like cold-hearted buffoons, and that I was the only one who kept his cool. I have also received letters and calls that focus on another issue. One Holocaust scholar was furious with me for accepting an invitation to debate the deniers. Had it not been for me, she argued, there would have been no show. How one should respond to claims one finds repugnant is a personal matter, but we should consider the ramifications of not responding. For example, when I speak with Holocaust scholars, they occasionally will say something like, "Off the record, I do not place much validity in survivors' testimony because their memories are faulty." Or, "Off the record, the deniers have identified some things that need further research." In my opinion, trying to keep these things off the record is going to backfire on historians. The deniers already know these things and are publicizing them. Do we want the public to think that we are covering up problems with the Holocaust story, or that we have somehow missed these things? At every lecture I have ever given on Holocaust denial, when I state that the human soap story is generally a myth, audiences are shocked. No one but Holocaust historians and Holocaust deniers seems to know that the mass production of soap from Jews is a myth. No bar of soap has ever tested positive for human fat. Do we want the Bradley Smiths and the David Coles of the world explaining such things to the public? By keeping silent on such important issues, our inaction may come back to haunt us.
This is the end of Side 3. Please turn over the tape for proper cueing of Side 4.